Welcome to the Seasons of Sobriety podcast. This is a podcast where you can join in the journey of other recovering alcoholics and addicts. You will be on the road with them as you listen to how each person came into recovery and how they persevered through times of anger, sadness, fear, and joy. I am your host, Howard M. I'm here to share my own experience as well as the experience of other recovering brothers and sisters. I am so grateful you have decided to join me today. This episode features Kathy K. from Northern New Jersey. Kathy has been sober since January 1st of 1987. Some of the valuable takeaways in Kathy's story are the following: an alternative approach to entering recovery from alcohol and drugs through the Al-Anon program, control issues and her relationship with food, insight into reciprocity and her personal friendships, and letting go of that feeling of uniqueness and separation from others. Here now is my interview with Kathy K. Welcome, Kathy, to the Seasons of Sobriety podcast.
Hi, Howard. Thanks for having me.
So I'd like
it's good to be here.
Yes, it is good to have you here. I'd like you to start off a little bit. If we look back to what was happening in, late 1986 or a little bit before that, and where you were at before you decided to come into recovery.
Sure. My early recollections really of any kind of awakening happened probably in 1983. Mm-hmm. I was working in Manhattan at the headquarters for Saks Fifth Avenue down on 15th Street between 9th and 10th Avenue. And my boss, Paula, said to me one day, you seem very sad. Is everything okay? And I remember thinking, well, gee, I'm okay. I certainly always had a smile on my face, was very quiet and sweet. And but inside, certainly, there was a lot of turmoil. And she called me in her office and said, what's going on? And I started to describe my home life. My mom, who had been really struggling with her drinking, and my sister, my older sister, Diane, who also was beginning to, she was drinking and then started to do Quaaludes and things like that. And her behavior was very erratic. So I described my home life, and Paula said, I heard about this thing called Al-Anon. What do you think? And I said, well, what's that? And she said, I think it's for families of alcoholics or something. And she said, we have a vendor. Why don't you talk to her? So the vendor came in, as usual, once a week. And she said to me, I go to Al-Anon, and it's helped me tremendously. There are meetings all over the place. And I said, well, I live in New Jersey, and I was in Manhattan, of course. And they're like, well, no, there's meetings all over the place. Right. It's not just in Manhattan. And they found me a meeting, and I went. And I got to the meeting, and they said, welcome. And why are you here? And I said, well, I want you to tell me how I can stop my mom's drinking. And they said, sit down, relax. why don't we talk about you, Kathy? Why don't we talk about you and what's going on with you? And so that was 83. Then in 84, I went to ACOA, Adult Children of Alcoholics, kind of deepening this kind of excavation really into who I am and what's going on in my life with my family. My mother continued to drink, my sister certainly continued, sadly, on her path of alcoholism. And in ACOA, I met a man, Alan, who took me to an AA meeting. I befriended him. So it's 84, 85, 86. And I was mentioning my drinking, how I drank and how I drugged, I was a binge drinker. I wouldn't drink every day, but every two weeks or 3 weeks, I'd start drinking on a Friday night. I'd be, calling sick on Monday, recuperating from, just hours and hours of partying, being out. I would go to after hour clubs in Manhattan. And he said, why don't you come to an AA meeting with me? Mm-hmm. I'm like, me? He's like, yeah, just, would you come with me? I said, okay. I liked him. I felt safe with him. He was funny. He was older, much older than I was at the time. I was probably 25. He's probably 50, 55. He was a playwright. He was a gay playwright living downtown in the West Village. And he said, my home group is Perry Street. Let's go to Perry Street. And I met him and we went inside Perry Street. And he said to me, before we got into the room, he said, I want you to identify with the feelings. Don't identify with the circumstances. Listen to the feelings. And I remember getting into Perry Street. I don't know if you've ever been, Howard, to Perry Street. It's a storefront. It's a very small, intimate room. The lights are dimmed. And at that time, there was coffee and cookies being served. And the lights dimmed and the speaker, the person began to share. And I remember just sitting there next to Alan, I'm listening. And at some point during the meeting, a transvestite walked into the room with a blonde matted wig and wearing a pink tutu. And I immediately focused on that. And the person went to the coffee where the coffee was and started, you know, took the milk and started downing the milk from the carton and eating the cookies, jamming the cookies into their mouth. And I just thought, I am not this crazy. I'm not this bad, you know. And we got out of the meeting and I said, Alan, I'm not crazy. And he said, No, don't look at the blonde transvestites in the room. You know, listen to the speaker. Right. And the seed of AA was planted, though. It was planted that day. And 86, I began dating someone. I went to a wedding. I met a fourth cousin. I started dating him. He was a drug dealer. It was a match made in heaven, you know. Right. And that relationship, this was October, November, December. We, we're drinking and drugging and, you know, with our families, his alcoholic family and mine. And it was December. Also, I just want to step back a little bit. Mm-hmm. My auntie Carol, who I'm very, very close with, this is my father's sister. I would see her frequently and she also noticed years ago, my behavior, very quiet, very sad, really, I guess you would say. And she recommended therapy. And she said, you know, there's a therapist I know of. And so in 86, I started going to see a therapist. And he was a Reikian therapist, mm-hmm. And at one point, you know, in one of our sessions, he said to me, because I would tell him about my drinking. And at one point he said to me, he looked me in the eye and he said, Kathy, if you continue to drink this way, you're wasting your time, you're wasting your money and you're wasting my time.
Wow.
And that was really like a cold splash of water in my face because I really heard that. And I was like, wow. Ooh, you know, it seemed harsh. And he was right. We weren't going to get anywhere if I was going to do what I was doing. So between therapy and this relationship that was really unfulfilling on every level, you know, I mean, I hit my bottom on New Year's Eve. We were together and we drank everything and snorted everything and smoked everything we could. Mm-hmm. And I felt empty and I wasn't high. I wasn't drunk. And I remember hearing a voice saying, Kathy, you need help. And it wasn't my boyfriend, Joey. You know, he was passed out somewhere. And I knew that, you know, I needed help. And I called AA when I got back to where I lived.
Okay. So kind of the path of Al-Anon and ACOA had led you into this, you know, kind of kept your mind open enough to receive perhaps what really was going on at this time. Yeah.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. I hear people say that they came to AA through the back door of Al-Anon, you know, and I feel that that's certainly my story.
Yeah, I think people come, there's side doors, there's little cracked open windows, there's all sorts of places we get, you know.
Trap doors.
Right.
Come out of cars.
Right, so this way, I thought we were going out. Yeah, well, no, we're here at a meeting for you. Oh, okay, you know. So, yeah, it is interesting how people get here.
Yes.
Had you circled back to your boss, Paula, and updated her at all at this time, or you just kind of went your own way and didn't reflect back to her what had happened?
She knew that I was going to Al-Anon. I had around 86. I got another job. I was working as a secretary, administrative assistant with Saks. And I always wanted to be a flight attendant. And my aunt encouraged me and she said, "You would be a great flight attendant. You should apply." And I did. And I was hired for American Airlines. And Paula and I, you know, certainly said our goodbyes. And Paula moved on to other things as well, worked for another company. And we've stayed connected via Facebook. I've seen her. She lives in Vermont. Uh-huh. And I saw her a few years ago. So,
Very nice. And how about Alan? Where is he in your story at this point?
He lives somewhere upstate. I've reached out to him. The last time I talked to him probably was 5 or 6 years ago.
Okay. Got it. Very nice. So as you're coming in, we'll say fresh off the boat, so to speak, but you're not, you're familiar with the steps. So, you know, you're not a stranger to what recovery is. How did that feel for you, kind of being new, but not so new? I mean, talk about that a little bit.
I felt scared.
Okay.
I remember just feeling really scared walking into my second technical, you know, AA meeting. It was the Gramercy Group, which used to meet Vincent's Hospital on 17th Street or 18th Street. Mm-hmm. And I was living now with my aunt in Stuyvesant Town on 20th and 1st Avenue. And I remember going to Intergroup. That was my first, I had called AA and I said, "Could you send me a meeting list?" Mm-hmm. And they said, "We don't do that. You know, you got to come here or we're going to tell you where meetings are." And so I went there and I walked to the Flatiron building. That's where it used to be, Intergroup. And I walked out and I really didn't know where I was going. I kind of looked around and this little old lady came up to me and tapped me on the shoulder. And she said, "You're looking for that room right over there." Now she said, "We alcoholics know each other now, don't we?" And I'm thinking, "Wow, this is wild, right? This is weird." And
yep,
AA Intergroup. I walked in, they went through, I was scared. I was terrified. I'm really terrified. And they opened up the meeting book. They said, "There's a meeting tonight at 7 o'clock, 3 blocks from where you live." I'm like, "Oh God, the bums and derelicts that are going to be there. The Bowery." This is what I thought AA was.
Right.
Even my experience in Al-Anon and AA and ACOA, still I just had that picture in my mind. And so I walked, I remember walking to the meeting, walking inside the room and just being, I knew I couldn't go on the way I was drinking. I knew that I just couldn't do it anymore. And, the room was filled with people who were so much better dressed than I was. Mm. I mean, professionals, beautiful men, women of all ages. It was an anniversary. They had a plastic cake. Mm-hmm. They were singing, you know, happy birthday or happy anniversary. And then, of course, they ask if this is anyone's first meeting or are you, you know. And so I raised my hand and I said, "I'm Kathy and I think I'm an alcoholic." And after the meeting, all these women, you know, just rushed towards me and how long are you sober? I'm like, 3 seconds, you know.
Right, I just told you.
Yeah. I mean, how long am I sober? And they immediately, "Here's my number. Call me. I'm going to a meeting tomorrow. I'm speaking the next night. We're going to the diner." So, but I was scared. I would say overall that was really the feeling.
Hmm. Okay. Yeah. And how long do you think it was, you know, that you were attending meetings or that before you found a sponsor and started to work the steps?
Well, this particular group had an interim sponsor program.
Okay.
So they recommended that I get a sponsor, an interim sponsor immediately. And they had a list of women who were available and willing to be temporary, you know, interim sponsors. So I was, Susan, the woman who became my temporary sponsor. And she was this gorgeous model who worked for the Tony Association. And she had this rock star husband. I mean, it was like something out of the movies. I went to her house, this gorgeous house in Gramercy Park. And we started going over the first step. We started, you know, reading. She had me reading the first step immediately, you know, within a week, I was doing the first step. And the other thing at the Gramercy group is they had a meeting for beginners, and it was for people with 6 months and under of sobriety. And it was chaired by someone with 5 years or more of sobriety. You had to have at least 5 years to chair the meeting. And the meet, so this was twice a week. You couldn't go into the big meeting until you went 6 months in the beginners meeting. So,
wow. So you kind of had to, you know, re-qualify to get to the grown-up table.
So yes, think. Yes, exactly.
Oh, that's pretty neat. That's pretty neat. Yeah. And it's funny, people are probably like, well, that's not right. You should be able to go wherever. It's like, then don't go to that meeting. It's okay. You know, go to a different one where they don't do it. It's okay. It's, you know, each meeting's autonomous. And, you know, I think had I been, coached a little bit better in the beginning, you know, 'cause as soon as I start to feel better, it's like, well, now I can just share, you know, in meetings where, you know, where there's people with, you know, 10, 20 years, and here I am with 6 months trying to tell them how to be sober. And I probably could have used something like that.
I'm telling you, Howard, it was looking back where I am today and looking back on those early years, it was such a strong foundation in the tenets, in the principles of the program. They didn't want to hear this. Became my home group. Not that they didn't want to hear what I had to say as a newcomer. They wanted me to be with other newcomers, and they wanted the newcomers to have a safe space to share what newcomers share.
Right.
You know, and they wanted someone in the room who could be listen, but also be so grounded in AA. I remember being in the group. The group started probably with 50 people. And at the end of the 6 months, maybe there were 12 or 10 people left. And I remember saying to, I got a different sponsor. Susan became pregnant. And so I then had Irene as my sponsor, who I went through all the steps with the first time. But I remember saying, asking this, what's wrong with me? All I think about is drinking. You know, I thought I was crazy. You know, and the woman chairing the meeting said, you're an alcoholic. That's why. But it seemed like such a dumb thing. But I felt safe asking that. And I think there's something to be said for newcomers not sharing to the degree that they do, in that that's why we have sponsors. Mm-hmm. You know, there's something to be said for developing that relationship. Irene really became my rock in AA in the early days. And she would say to me, we share in a general way, Kathy. And what you have to bring, I want you to bring things to me, you know, just so you and I can develop that intimacy and that honesty. And what step are we going to use to work through whatever you're going through at whatever time? And mostly it was the first step. We spent a long time on that, but yeah.
Yeah, because if you look up the word sponsor, it's kind of like someone who's bringing somebody into something, and kind of leading them a certain way. And I think we sometimes lose sight of that, where it's just just someone to kind of hang out with or chit chat with. And but no, it's someone, you know, who I need to go to exclusively for certainly in the beginning, and make sure I get clarity and make sure I get on the right track. And that experience, like you said, I can bring to the meeting, you know, share in a general way what it used to be like, what happened, what we are like now. And sometimes it's like, well, when I say what it used to be like, maybe isn't, you know, 20 years ago, 30 when I was drinking, what it used to be like is a week ago, prior to me discovering that I had this character defect. You know what I'm saying? That kind of thing. So it doesn't really give that little time frame. It says what we used to be like. Yeah. Before this week, I was nuts, you know. I mean, especially with what's going on, you know, in our current society, and it's like with this lockdown and shutdown and all these things and masks, and it's like there are things beyond my control, and it's painful to find this new level of powerlessness, you know.
Absolutely, absolutely, yeah. Yeah, and I think, you know, for me, I never really trusted. That was part of my really exploring myself and my willingness to trust and be vulnerable with another human being, which, you know, was in the fifth step truly. But to get to the fifth step, Irene and I, she asked me, call me every day. I said, but what am I going to say to you every day? Just call me. Just say, hello, how are you? This is my day. How's your, just call me. And then just that slow practice of reaching out to her and establishing trust. And as we went through the steps and when we finally, you know, when we got to the fifth step, it was that I had that level of trust with her that was so essential, really, I think in the process.
So let's talk a little bit about your step work. You're coming in, I think you've talked enough about identifying the powerlessness and unmanageability. Where was your walk with God at this point, or the God of your understanding? Where were you when you first came in?
I would probably say I was confused. I had grown up, I went to a Catholic school, kindergarten through the eighth grade. I had gone through the sacraments, certainly of, you know, baptism and communion and confirmation. I grew up in a very Catholic home, my grandparents on both sides, my mother. So I was very familiar with that kind of practice, going to church, the rituals that Catholics do, praying, confession. But I felt like the Catholic Church was like kind of dry. It didn't really have any juice for me. It didn't have any zing. And I was looking. I was definitely looking. So when I came in, I read Came to Believe. Irene recommended that I read the literature, our AA literature on Came to Believe, because I really grappled with that. You know, I wanted something, but I didn't know what it was. And she would say things like, the group can be your higher power, you know, all the, you know, good or orderly direction. We went to the beach once and Irene said to me, this is my church. This is really where I feel close to my higher power when I'm in nature. And I think reading Came to Believe helped me a lot. And, I explored Buddhism and I had a guru for a while. And now I'm kind of back to, there are Catholic things that I practice, praying a certain way and just certain things that I grew up with that are comfortable for me and that I feel at ease with. Okay. It was a process, certainly finding a higher power that was of my understanding.
Okay.
It was like my conditioning as a Catholic. It's kind of rigid and it's not a very loving God. And, it's more man-made, I guess. It's a lot of guilt and a lot of shame. And I didn't resonate with that.
You did find your own understanding with that
I did,
foundation.
Yes.
Yeah, great.
Yes.
As you're developing this and you're getting to the third step and now the fourth step, can you talk a little bit about your fourth step process?
My first fourth step with Irene, Irene had taken me through the 12 and 12 initially.
Okay.
We didn't do the big book. And when I work with my sponsees, that's how I bring them through the steps because that's how I learned.
Okay.
So we got to the fourth step. And I just want to say Irene was very clear prior to getting to the fourth step. Irene and I were in a diner. I think it was the Moonstruck Diner in Manhattan. And she said to me, are you sure? Are you sure you're ready to take the third step? And I said, yeah. You know, I was like, all right, come on. She said, no, I want you to be very certain that you're ready to turn your will and your life over to the care of, God of your understanding. And I really had to pause because I think she was letting me know that we're about to delve very deep now, Kathy. We're about to really go deep. I want you to feel grounded and secure. She didn't say this, but when I think about it now, it's very important. We have our relationship, you and I, and your relationship with your higher power, which is going to help you for the next remaining steps. So we paused at three, and I really thought about it and felt in my heart I had taken the third step. And we said a prayer together, and then we started on the fourth step.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And at one point, I said to her, she said, I really want you to consider your assets as well as your liabilities. And we had addressed, which is in the big book, I think there's assets. Well, it's what I did, Mr. Brown, things like that. She said, I want you to list your assets and your liabilities. And I couldn't think of any assets. Mm-hmm. And she said, Kathy, you have assets. There are things about you that really are wonderful, and I want you to find what they are. And that was hard. You know, I brushed my teeth every day. I said, that's an asset. She said, Kath. Like, I was so hard on myself, yeah. You know, so hard on myself. And I'm very thankful to her, because also with my sponsees, I do the same thing. What are your assets? What are your liabilities, certainly, and what are your assets? I think the balance of both, because it's not all, you know, I did this, I hurt this person, you know, so.
Okay. And what did you, and as you thought about it, what did you discover were your assets?
I was a good listener. Mm-hmm. I was a positive. I was somebody who's like really saw the positive in things. Mm-hmm. I laughed easily. I made other people laugh easily. I was fun to be with. People would say to me, there's a calm about you. And I found that too. I found, oh yeah, there's something about me that has this calming effect that puts people at ease. Things like that.
Very nice. Very nice. And what do you think the benefit is, going through the 12 and 12 first and then through the big book?
I feel like the 12 and 12 really explains what's going on. You know, it's just a much, for me, like a much clearer description. Mm-hmm. The big book, you know, I have gone through the big book. I did the How program at one point through the big book, and it was helpful. I don't know. I just feel like it's meatier in the 12 and 12.
Okay.
That's been my experience.
Okay. Yeah. And that's why I'm asking. There are people who are listening to this saying, oh, no, the big book's the only way to do it. And there's people saying, no, I got through with the 12 and 12. You know, and I think your experience is important when people want to know, is there alternatives sometimes to what they hear, you know, over and over and over again.
Yeah. Yeah. And I have to say, there are times when I will say, you know, some of the things in the 12 and 12, like in the third step, when they talk about being on the Salerno beachhead, mm-hmm. you know, and how you're in the midst of all this and your higher power, you know, really having to turn over your will and your life over to the care because you're in this dangerous situation. And there have been times I've gotten on the phone with people and I've said, I'm on the Salerno beachhead, and they know exactly what I'm talking about. You know, and just other things in like in the 10th step, you know, restraint of pen and tongue, just those little things that are kind of anchors, you know, some kind of grounding, some kind of, I don't know how to describe it. It's just the depth that it goes, the 12 and 12 goes into, was very helpful to me. And again, I think it really built my foundation and gave me a very strong foundation in the program in the beginning.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. One of the things that you actually mentioned, the restraint of pen and tongue. The one other one that jumps out that the 12 and 12 made more clear for me is the instincts in collision, you know, talking about, mm-hmm. you know, our drive to be social and to be, to want money to support ourselves and all these drives, how we went overboard with them. And then we just became, you know, regularly at odds with people because we were fighting so much for these things that are normal. But I took them to a degree that made me very, you know, difficult to be around. And so I do like the clarity that the 12 and 12 gives on that. So
yes, yes.
So you were talking a little bit also about your fifth step and how Irene made it very comfortable for you to share and be vulnerable with her. Can you tell us a little bit what you discovered maybe in these aha moments of your character defects? Is there anything that stands out where you're like, oh boy, I never knew I was like this, you know, fill in the blank with this. Can you talk a little bit about that?
During that first fifth step, Irene said, I was nervous, you know, we said the serenity prayer, and I had my fourth step written pages and pages and pages, and we went through it. And what I discovered really is that I'm not so unique. Mm. That was probably, I walked away thinking, oh, I'm a member of the human race. I am, you know, that terminal uniqueness. I used to hear it a lot more. I don't hear that much anymore of how I thought I was unique in the way that I operated or the things I did or said or didn't say or how I withheld or whatever I did. And Irene said to me, you know, as we sat there, she said, I want you to know, I've heard it all before. I've heard everything I have. I'm not going to judge you in any way. Everything that you tell me is between you and I and God. And, you know, if it has a name, right, it's not unique. Mm-hmm. And I walked away really feeling like right size, like I'm not so unique, but I'm not like on the bottom. You know, it's like you're either on the top, yep, or on the bottom. I felt like I was always on the bottom, and I wasn't on the bottom anymore. Mm.
Yeah, the expression I like is ego is not how much or how little you think of yourself, it's how often you think of yourself. Right? Because if I think I'm the lowest of the low, it's like, all the time. And guess what I'm thinking about? Me.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah. So the other day I was helping someone at work, and I teach at high school, and so we're wearing masks. We're trying to do as much as we can in person, but there's a lot asked of us, and most of the faculty are worn out, you know, and tired. And a woman came up to me, and she said, "Boy, you seem to be doing this so well." And I said, I looked at her straight. I says, "No, I cry at home. I just don't cry here." And she's like, "Wow, okay, I didn't expect that much honesty." And I said, "Well, I just want you to understand you're not alone, you know, unique or, but really it's like, you're not alone." And it was really a moment where the next day she said, "I want to thank you for letting me know how tough this is for you. Cause you know, I think I'm the only one, you know," and it's like, no, you're not the only one. So it's nice to join, isn't it? The human race, right?
It really is.
Stop the fighting and the resistance of being different.
Exactly.
Okay. So as we look into the sixth step, and I'll talk about the way it frames up in the 12 and 12, because I do really like that first line. It says, "This is the step that separates the men from the boys." And of course, we can go on and on about some of the sexist language of our literature. But what I was told, you know, when I was done arguing about that, they said, "Well, actually, what it was really saying is this separates the adults from the children." Can you talk a little bit about how you started to mature into adulthood? Because you had mentioned, you know, you stopped drinking, or you were drinking, you know, at 12 years old, and you felt like a 12-year-old when you came in here, and now you're starting to mature into a woman. Can you talk about that relative to the sixth step?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, it definitely is. This is where you grow up. Absolutely. Mm. This is where your behavior starts to change. My behavior started to change. And it was, and continues to be, I'm still growing up in ways I couldn't imagine. And I, you know, and I probably will be, hopefully, till the day I die, you know, growing and changing and accepting things in a certain way about myself and others. And so with Irene, working the sixth and seventh step, we would get to a situation, something at work where a coworker had said something, and I was very offended about, I was very offended by what he said. And she said, "Well, I'd like you to go back and have a conversation with him and tell him how you feel. And you're working together. This is your coworker. He's not going to disappear." You know, and I said, I'll just ignore him. like every, I'll avoid him, right? I mean, I just, there's ways to do it. I don't have to go directly. She said, no, no. She said, we'll role play. And so we did. We would role play. I would be me. She would be my coworker. She would be me and I would be my coworker. And we just practiced. She said, okay, you know, you're ready. And I went to my coworker and I said what I said. And I didn't say it like you did this and you did that. Use the I statement. I, you know, I felt whatever that was at that moment. And I, and we're, you know, and afterward he said, oh, I'm sorry. I, you know, he was very kind of like surprised that I said this and, you know, and he was grateful. He was like, yeah, no, no, let's, and we, you know, worked together. We worked together on, it was on a different level. But it was scary. It was scary to do that. I had never asserted myself in that way. I avoided, I stayed quiet, you know, but that had to change, you know? And there were financial things I did, financial mistakes that I made. And Irene said, well, you're going to pay that back and you're going to, oh, and I'm like, oh, oh, you know? And yeah, I paid it back. You know, I paid back. I had, she would call them expensive lessons. And, you know, it stung, a lot of stinging growing up and a lot of financial stuff and a lot of just people stuff. With, when I'm in my apartment by myself, I'm fine.
Sure.
I used to say this when I was single and I'm single again, but I would say when I'm in my apartment, I'm fine. It's when other people come into the picture is when everything gets messed up. So I had to look at myself, really look at myself and be willing to act and behave differently.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was thinking, you know, a child, like you said, the avoidance, and you know, like I'll just go find another sandbox. Why can I just, you know, play over here and you know in the other corner of the sandbox? And it's like, no, adult learns how to work with the sand with the other people, and that's what we do. And
exactly,
AA helps us grow up, I think, in a way that seems so weird and foreign. And then you go ask someone who's been a grown up for a long time and they're like, yeah, that's what I do. Like they don't fight this urge to you know to be a child. They really don't. It's fascinating. It's like, how did you just apologize right away? Well, because I was wrong. Yeah, but didn't you find a reason not to apologize? Nope. It's like some of these people out there are like, wow, that's neat. I hope I get there one day.
Yes.
Yeah, it's good. Okay. So, so now we're kind of getting into the amends phase and, I'd like you to talk a little bit about some of the amends or, you know, that process of making the list and determining who to go to right away and who to wait on, you know, and all that. Can you talk about that, please?
Certainly. You know, I'm thinking I've done the steps probably five times.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure I'll do another round very soon. Probably in 2021, probably every 5 years I do a round of steps,
okay.
Step work. So I'm thinking of the various eighth and ninth steps that I've made. And some were, you know, in particular, I'm thinking I was working with a sponsor, Naomi, and it was kind of a sex inventory. It was going over. And when I say sex, I mean, just a list of people, men that had been my boyfriends or people who I'd liked or didn't, just these relationships that just really needed to be addressed. And there was one in particular. So I had my list and Naomi and I went through the list very carefully because she said, you know, some of these amends you don't need to make, you know, it's not necessary. And there was some, maybe two or three that were necessary. And one in particular, I just did just a few years ago. It was someone I dated probably 10 or so years ago, maybe 20 years ago. And I always felt that I had owed him an apology for the way that I behaved in our relationship. And he was living in the town that I was living with. He was married. He's married. He's got children. He's doing very, very well. And she said, no, I think this amends is appropriate. I said, well, what should I do? She said, I would pray about it, you know, pray about it. And we had gone over it very carefully, which I really strongly recommend just again, the sponsorship relationship and doing this work with someone who knows you and who says, no, you don't have to do that. Or yes, this is necessary, or can see a whole nother, you know, aspect of it that I couldn't see. So I prayed about it and I went to a Starbucks one day and in walks Steve and he sits down. I said, oh, okay. All right. So I went up to him. I said, hi, Steve. He said, oh, Kathy, hi. I said, how are you? I he's like, I'm good. I'm good. And I said, do you have a minute? He said, yeah. And I made my amends. And I was very clear, you know, what amends specifically, what I needed to say. And he looked at me and he said, you know, don't worry about it. It was a lot. We were young. I said, no, but I felt it was in there and I needed to say that to you. And yeah. And that was it. He said, you know, it's good to see you. I said, it was good to see you. And then I called Naomi and I said, I just saw Steve and I made my amend and it went well in Starbucks.
That's great. So. That's great. Yeah. Are there any amends that kind of didn't go well that you'd like to share with the audience? Sometimes people are like, you know, some of them, they sting a little. Could you talk about it?
Yes. A friend, Anna Cecilia, I was moving from San Juan to New Jersey, and she was very helpful during that move. And we had a friendship. You know, and now we were, you know, anticipating getting closer and closer. And when I got to New Jersey, I began to not spend as much time with her. And I began to go in other directions. And at one point she reached out to me and she said, I'm very hurt. I'm very hurt that you've, you know, that this relationship has gone in this direction. And she was on an 8-step amends list. And I asked my sponsor, what should I do? And she said, why don't you write her a letter and tell her that you're sorry and that you'd like to still remain friends and that you'd like to amend this relationship by spending time with her. And is there anything that she would like to say to you? So I wrote her a letter. And a couple of weeks later, I got a letter back saying, thank you for your letter. I don't want to be friends with you anymore. I don't want a friend like you in my life. And that stung. I was hurt, but I thought, well, you know, okay. You know, I was sad about it. Sure. But she had decided that, you know, no, I want someone who's going to show up. I don't want to flake. I don't want to, you know. I wasn't there for her, and that's not something she wanted to be around. So,
Now, do you think that helped you think about your other relationships where you might have been unreliable or flaky, as you said, and perhaps maybe did a preemptive amends and changed in the midst of that, so you wouldn't have to make that amend to them again?
Yeah. I think that's also growing up. For me, of realizing the impact that I have on other people, you know, and that they have on me, like that my friends really care and they want me to be around. They, you know, that reciprocity in a relationship, you know, I didn't know how much someone's heart was in it. You know, I just kind of took that for granted. I was unconscious to that. And today, you know, my friends, you know, it's kind of ongoing because, you know, my one friend will say, well, I don't see you. Where are you? I want to see you. And I'll say, well, I want to see you too. And this is what's going on. And we'll make it a point. So we see each other every 6 months, but we see each other, you know, so it's, yeah. Does that make sense?
Sure. Yeah. It's I only have so much energy to give to a certain number of people in any given day, week, month, year. And I'm very fortunate to have accumulated a lot of very close relationships, and yet I don't have time for all of them. And so it bothers me sometimes that I forget to text and it just gets buried in a bunch of other messages. And I realize 2 days later, I didn't even reply and say thank you, or let me call you this weekend. And it turns out they are also just as busy. I mean, it's not someone, you know, I'll say a primary relationship like my wife or son. So if she sends a text message, I don't get back for 2 days, that's a problem, you know? So it's some of these more secondary or tertiary relationships where, it's okay on both sides. You know, if they didn't get back to me either, yeah, they're busy. I'm not in their life enough for them to, sorry, for me to be, expect an immediate response. You know, if I want something immediate, I better make a phone call and leave a message saying, I need to talk to you as soon as possible. You know, I can't leave something float out there. That's on me, you know, waiting for them to look. So,
Yeah. Well, that's a good point too. It's like, what kind of relationship do we have?
Yes.
You know, is this my son? Is this my son's father? Is this a relative? Is this a very, you know, one or two of my trusted friends? Or is this, you know, where are we at? And the time and energy, putting time and energy into, you know, using it wisely, I think.
Yeah. I mean, me and my wife have actually used this system for work where we don't really call each other at work. And since we met, it's just something that we could talk after work. There's nothing that needs to be talked about during the day. And so sometimes I'll be having a conversation with someone, my phone will ring and they're like, do you have to get that? I said, no, it's not my wife. And they're like, oh, like, no, everybody else can wait. and if I'm with you, a face-to-face conversation, that's more important than who's ever calling right now. However, if my wife calls me during the workday, I'm going to stop and I'm going to pick it up because there's a problem, you know, so I kind of like this development of when it's something's urgent and when it's important, you know, that people talk about that in business and all sorts of other things. But I like to think of it, you know, in terms of just even a phone call or, you know, what do I have to do right now and what can wait and what can wait a day, what can wait a week, you know, all that kind of thing. Cause I'll pile stuff on myself like crazy and make myself nuts cause I didn't do everything today, you know? So, Okay. Well, thank you. So now we're into, steps 10 and 11. I'm kind of putting them together a little bit. Talk a little bit about, you know, practicing the 10th step, you know, during, you know, your day to day. Like you said, you've been through the steps a number of times. And I think, you know, you know well enough now about the 10th step, what that looks like in any given day. Can you talk about an experience where you took that spot check inventory and you know, admitted you were wrong, you know, immediately or close to immediately?
It usually happens at work with a coworker.
That's what I was going to say.
Where I'll be snippy or rude or, you know, just in my own, you know, focused and wanting to get something done, and I'll be curt with them, and I'll step back. I'll go, oh, I could feel it. I could feel it now. It's hard to describe. It's people who are sober. When I got sober, they would say that something happens to them as they stay sober. Like, it's like an intuitiveness, some sense of, I don't know how to describe it exactly. But I could feel it in my body. And when I feel it in my body, like, ooh, that's not cool, Kath, or that's not how I want to feel in my body. So I'll go to my coworker and I'll say, I'm sorry. I was not, you know, paying attention, or I wasn't listening to you. And I just want to apologize. I'm sorry. It happens. I'm in an environment, and I'm not going to blame it on my environment. I have to really, you know, hungry, angry, lonely, tired.
Sure.
Yesterday I was so hungry. And I stopped and I was with my two coworkers and I said, I really have to eat something or I'm going to bite somebody's head off. And they're like, okay, Kath, you better, yeah, right. Okay. You know, so I know if something, it's always about what's going on inside of me, you know, it's not people, places, and things anymore. It's really and that's what they said over and over in the beginning, you know, it's inside of you. It's always new. And I hated that. I was like, no, it's not me. It's them. It's my family. It's not, it's me. And I have to get right with me, whether I have to eat something or take a break or go. I've walked around the block and come back and apologized. I've also taken a couple of days because my anger was so hot that I was going to say things that I really, really would regret. So that's kind of how it looks today.
Yeah, that's good because not yesterday, but this past Friday, I was calling, our friend Tom, right? So I called up Tom and he said, "What's up?" I don't normally call him this early in the morning before work. I said, "Oh, I'm about to lose my job." He said, "Well, what happened?" I said, "Nothing yet. I'm about to say something that's going to cause me to lose my job. I need you to talk me out of it." and I'm about to talk to the wrong person at the wrong time and say definitely the wrong thing. Cause I was all worked up and he said, "Well, what if I gave you permission to do it, but you had to wait till Monday?" I was like, "Oh, okay. I'll wait till Monday," And by Monday I was like, "Yeah, what was I going to talk about again?" So sometimes that moment, like you said, you take a couple days off or you just force yourself. It's like, well, if you're not allowed to say anything until 2 days from now, what would you do? Well, fine. I'll do everything else. And then I'll come back to it 2 days from now. It's like, and then it's gone, it's let go. Right.
Exactly. That's brilliant. It's that pause, right? It's that just pause. Don't, jump. Don't. Yeah.
Yep. And so that leads us into, prayer and meditation. So could you talk a little bit about how that has grown and enhanced in your life through the 11th step?
I feel like my practice as a child now, I was told as a child I had a guardian angel.
Hmm.
My grandmother told me that, and I believed her. And I was told that, that God's watching over me, And so I really feel the practice of sometimes it's a formal sitting down, meditating for at least five minutes. I have the Insight Timer app and I'll use that. Or it's sitting with other people in a room or in a meeting. Just taking that time to enhance and to get with, this is the most important relationship, I think, the relationship with my higher power. Hmm. This is the one, it feels like it's inside of me, that my higher power is not something outside, but inside of me.
Yeah.
And not that I'm my higher power, I'm not, but I feel like when I go within, something gets revealed or something gets opened up, some calm comes up from within. And no matter what's going on the outside, that inside connection, which also is where AA is for me, mm-hmm. it's really inside of me. I've internalized it, that I'm okay, that I can go where I need to go today, and do what I need to do. And I do pray a lot. I do pray a lot. Help me, show me, guide me. Thank you. So we'll continue to evolve, I'm sure.
Yeah.
And I look to my friends who are also sober and their kind of relationship that they have, their 11-step practice, which some people amazes me, how their meditation practice or their depth of their prayer. I could see it in their eyes. And I just want to say this, when I first got sober, the old timers used to say, I would walk into a meeting and they were watching me as I would, day by day.
Yep.
And at one point, one of them said, "She's getting it. We could see it in her eyes."
Yeah.
And they could see my soul. That's what they could see. And I see that in other people. I could see the light coming, emanating from their eyes. And I know it's like this. Something, their light, that was obstructed with alcohol is now, the alcohol is being taken away and the anger and the resentment, a lot of light comes pouring out of them.
Yeah. Yeah. That's good stuff. Yeah. It's funny, like me and you now are now the long timers or, right. The old timers, what do you want to call us? Right. And it's like, Yeah, we can see it. We can see it. And what hurts even more is sometimes when I see the hope leave in their eyes, and it's like, oh gosh, I really hope they come back, you know, and, you know, or let me go find them after the meeting and have a conversation, because you can see it leave, right? You know what I'm talking about, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
Well, this leads to step 12, which talks about a few things, you know, having had a spiritual awakening and, you know, carrying the message and practicing these principles in all our affairs, which is, you know, we could spend, you know, hours on that. But would you talk a little bit about what it's like for you being a sponsor these days?
I have, as I said, I have on paper, I have four sponsees, one of which who I work with regularly.
Okay.
We do, we're doing step work. We've gone through the 12 and 12 and now we're using the big book. And I speak to her once a week, every Sunday, and she'll text me or call me during the week when something comes up, you know, if she's really going through something at work or with her family. The other sponsees, I did hear from another sponsee the other day who moved to Philadelphia, who I had no idea. Oh, you moved to Philadelphia.
Of course. Okay. What was I thinking that you might call me? Yeah, right.
Exactly. Maybe you might let me know. Another sponsee I have not heard from. So, you know, I was taught that I have to do the work. I have to call my sponsor. I have to be willing to do the work. That I couldn't chase after anybody. And not that I don't care. I do. But it's kind of, it's wonderful. Let me just say, the sponsee that I'm working with, it's wonderful because we read together and we talk about things and I have my experience and she has her experience in her life. And it's very rich. It's just rich to read to be sober together. And then I know her and I have the privilege of being in her life and working these things through with her through the steps. So it's really a privilege. And the other sponsees, I pray for them. I hope they're okay. I trust that they're, you know, on their path. And when they do call, they'll say, oh, I meant to call, but, you know, 3 months went by. And as long as you don't drink,
yeah.
If you're going to drink, you have to call me. You know, and they're like, no, but I have a new boyfriend and I have a new, you know, something else. So.
And what could you tell someone listening to this? What's a mistake you made as a sponsor that you're like, oh, please don't do this because this is what happened to me. Can you share a little bit about that?
I think probably what. There was a time in my life where I really shouldn't have sponsored someone.
Hmm.
I just was not available.
Hmm.
And I said yes. And I was not available. I was not there in the way that a sponsee needs a sponsor. And she was very hurt. And I said, I'm sorry. I should have been more honest. I shouldn't have said yes to this relationship. And she said, well, you know, I wish you would have told me so I think that's the thing. If you really can't sponsor someone, don't, you know, if you really can't take them on there are people that now who call me and I'll say, well, where are you at? And if they're like, they're just coming in, I'm not the person, you know, I'm not the person. You really need to honor that, a newcomer really needs and should have someone who's very available. And there are people who are, you know, who are available and have kind of the rigor, the regimen, the discipline, the time really to be there for them daily.
Mm, that's, you know, that's very good insight. I have learned that lesson myself, and where it's like, I really took on too much and I became frustrated because more about me, but I put the frustration on them and that was unfair to them. And so I had to come to terms with the fact that I said yes to something I should have said no to. Yeah. It's tough.
Yeah. Yeah.
What we'd like you to unpack for us is something that you talked about in the background information about your food issues and where that came about and how that changed the direction of your recovery. Can you do that for us, please?
Certainly. I was probably 31 years sober, and I had I was living with my son. My son, certainly he was 14 at the time, and my mom, who was 87, my mom had come to live with us, both to help out with my son, so for an emotional help and for financial help in our living situation. So the three of us were living together, and my mom had had bouts of certainly diabetes. She was alcoholic, had stopped drinking when she moved in with us. And then she had breast cancer. So my mom was going through breast cancer treatment. And I decided that I was going to be, I was not going to eat sugar all the time because I was eating enormous amounts of sugar, which I've always eaten a lot of sugar. I was the sugar baby, bazooka girl every day after school when I was a kid. So I discovered this thing called the gray sheet. I read a book by Judy Collins called Cravings, and it discussed, Judy talked about her her addiction with food and sugar and wheat. And she's also recovering in other programs as well. So I was very inspired by Judy, and I thought, okay. So I found the gray sheet. I found a sponsor. And in the gray sheet, you don't eat any sugar. You don't eat any wheat. You don't eat any flour, no peas, no corn, no nuts, no juice. It's very clean, just vegetables, fruits, yogurt, water, black coffee. And I started this program. I started in December of 2017, I think it was. And I immediately lost 5 pounds in a week. And I felt great. I felt great. And I part of the program is I would commit my food to my gray sheet sponsor every day. I would tell her exactly what I was going to eat, how much I was going to eat. Everything was weighed and measured. And there was no deviation from that plan. So I lost 5 pounds, then 10 pounds, then 15 pounds, then 20 pounds, then 25 pounds. And people were like, wow, Kathy, you look great. You look terrific. Wow, what are you doing? And I told them, oh, I'm doing this food program. And then I started, you know, then it was 30, 35 pounds and 40 pounds and 45 pounds. And now I was looking gaunt and very thin. And people were saying, are you sick? Are you okay? Do you have cancer? And I was sharing this with my sponsor, and she said, don't worry about my food sponsor at the time. And not doing step work, by the way, just doing the food, no step work, even though it was encouraged, but there has to be a particular kind of sponsor with going through the steps. And I hadn't found that sponsor. So I started looking at myself and realizing that I had come under the illusion of control, that I was in control of my food and I was in control of my life. And I became very curt and short with my mother and my son. I was irritable, discontent. I had to buy clothing all the time because I was getting thinner and thinner and thinner. It went from you look great to have you seen a doctor? I think you really need to see a doctor. And I realized that something happened to me. Something was ignited, some kind of, I call it control, the drug of control. Like I told myself I could control this, but truly I couldn't. I was out of control. I was almost, 135 pounds. That's what I weighed in high school. I wasn't myself. My eyes were vacant. You know, when we spoke about the eyes, when you see light coming from eyes or lost hope, I was in a Target fitting room buying another set of clothes because I had lost. I was down another size. And I looked in my eyes that were empty. And I said, I'm gonna bring you back. I promise I'm gonna come and I'm gonna get you. And I was talking to my soul. And I kind of woke up and I reached out to my friend Ellen in the program. And I said, I'm out of control. Something's not right with me. And together, you know, she helped me to kind of get back to a normal eating routine. I went back to my step work, back to turning my will and my life over, because I really felt that I took it back. And it was a scary time. I did not pick up alcohol, thank God. But I never imagined at 31 years that I would be this spiritually sick. Mm-hmm. But it was months of my own will, months of my own being my own higher power. And food was my thing that I was controlling. So I want to say, early in my sobriety, I was at the 14th Street workshop, and a man came over to me, and I'd seen him there frequently. He was articulate and funny and bright. He was about 30 years sober when I had seen him. And he came to me one day. He came in and he didn't look well. Hmm. And he said to me, I'm going into an institution. I said, what's going on? He said, well, I had a nervous breakdown. I said, but you're 30 years sober. What do you mean? He's like, I had a nervous breakdown. And I remember thinking, how can you possibly have a nervous breakdown with 30 years of sobriety? And then I realized you can't have 31 years of sobriety, way off the track, way off the beam. And I'm lucky that I really got back, honestly. And I've heard that this happens to people. I'm not unique, certainly in any way. I'm still not unique, but it taught me a lot, you know. It just taught me a lot about control and how I was so out of control, but I'm never in control, really. But this, does it make sense what I'm saying?
Yeah. It reminds me of years ago when I was, doing an inpatient codependency treatment, when this therapist said to me, and there are people there with various levels of sobriety and substances, and there was food and there was sex and gambling and all sorts of things, and, you know, amongst alcohol and drugs. And she said to us in a group, she says, I want you to all understand that as you sit here, you picked up two new drugs. One of them is control, and the other one is chaos. And when you try to get a little bit of one, you can't get enough of the other. And unless you, again, enhance yourself spiritually, this is going to be your life now. And we were all just like sitting there in silence, saying, you know, that addiction to control. I want to have everything my way. Or the addiction to the chaos, just piling more and piling more and piling more until, like you said, it's a nervous breakdown. And so it makes perfect sense to a guy like me who thought that once I got sober, everything would get better and nothing would get worse. That was a myth, but that's what I wanted to believe.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. And honestly, I say to people, I think everybody should have a nervous breakdown at least once in their lives. I really do. It's really cathartic. It's really, there's something about it that you really, it was such a bottom. And I've had many bottoms in sobriety. This was the lowest I'd ever been. But their end, I feel like I needed that. I was humbled by it. I saw the people who loved me so deeply, who were there for me. I felt my higher power. I don't think I would have been able to experience that unless I had hit the depth of, you know, the low depth of that, or had gone through that.
Yeah, I've had those moments too. And it's just like that moment where, okay, now are you ready to receive God's will? How about now? Not yet? Okay. Keep making it worse. It's okay. And like you said, I had some very loving, patient people. Like you see, you mentioned Ellen and some other people, and, you know, thank God they put up with my crap while I got better. Because it wasn't like a light switch, like, oh, okay, I'm better. Let's get better now. It's like, no, it was a pull and a tug and a push and a smack in the face. It was all sorts of things. So,
absolutely. It was months of really being in bed. Hmm. And then, you know, people would say, get up, get dressed, go to work, get up. And it was like, and I had to call them. What do? You get dressed, you go to work, put on some makeup, yeah. Go to work, come back. I'd go to bed. Weeks, months, you know, yeah. But loving, it's going to be all right. You're going to be okay. And it's tough. It's tough, but it's, you know, I'm grateful. Honestly, I'm grateful that I went through it. I just felt things and saw things I couldn't have possibly experienced, as I said earlier. So, yeah.
But it does take that moment where you're looking in the mirror and really, that's not metaphorical for you. You were literally looking in a mirror and saying, this has to stop. And having the courage with a lot of time to raise your hand and say, yeah, I need help today. This is, you know, I am not happy, joyous, and free. And it's sometimes when you have a lot of time and you're in a room full of new people, like, I'm not saying it with these people here. And then you're like, well, maybe tomorrow. Not yet. And it fades and fades until you have to say something. So I'm glad you did.
Yeah. Thank you, Howard. And you too. And you too. Now, yeah.
So let's talk a little bit about the other piece that you talked about is your divorce and some of the background information and how something so painful initially opened up some opportunities for you. Can you talk about that, please?
Sure. I was, I married in 2001 in mm-hmm. February in Puerto Rico in 2001. My son was born in 2005.
Okay, and
Jorge.
Just for context, how much sobriety did you have when you got married?
15 years.
Okay.
My son was born in 2005. I was 3 days shy of my 44th birthday.
Oh wow!
Yeah, what a gift! And Jorge was looking for work. He couldn't find work, and he found a good job in Puerto Rico. This is where he's from. Mm-hmm. So we moved to Puerto Rico. And in Puerto Rico, we were living very close to the beach. We had a lovely lifestyle. He had a great job. We were in the Caribbean. My in-laws were there. There's a lot of, you know, a lot of good about it. And my marriage was just not working. You know, it just wasn't working. We had gone to marriage counseling, and you know, I certainly looked at my part as a sober woman, and he was doing his part. But we couldn't really connect in a way to sustain a marriage. I you'll tell me, Howard, about marriage, please. I feel like it's almost like this when I look at married people, long-term marriage, I think, how do they do it? Like, how do they sustain that? And maybe it's a day at a time. I don't know, but I'll ask you. But so my marriage was beginning to disintegrate, and it did in Puerto Rico. We divorced in 2011 in Puerto Rico. Mm-hmm. And about that time, I wanted to come back to New Jersey. I was not someone who enjoyed living in the Caribbean. It's a different lifestyle. It's a different rhythm. Mm-hmm. And it's not one that I resonated with. So my mother had recommended that I ask a cousin in Montclair if she had an apartment available in Montclair, New Jersey, which is always where I've wanted to live. I thought it was a very progressive, literate town. Mm-hmm. And I reached out to her. And she said, yes, I do. So I got the apartment. And then I reached out to another cousin who said, yes, we need help at the family business. Mm-hmm. So my marriage certainly ended, and my home and a job opened up. So out of that, very sad when a marriage ends. It's sad, you know, it's a death really. So, but I started working and living in a great town.
Wonderful. And how's your son, how's he doing with all this?
He's okay. You know, he was 6 years old when we divorced. Mm-hmm. He's now 15. We've recently moved. We were living in Montclair. We just moved to another town. And I'm on the second floor and my ex-husband is on the third floor. It's like a sitcom.
Really?
Yes. Yes.
So he came back and then he lived
in... came upstairs. Oh. It's funny. But my son loved Montclair, so he's not happy that we've moved out of Montclair.
Mm, okay.
And he goes to a school in Jersey City, a high school. So he's much closer to his high school. He's going to stay in the high school. He's a sophomore. And he's getting used to it here. It's a little more congested. It's a little more densely populated. Mm-hmm. We're in North Bergen is where we are right now. So, yeah.
Gotcha. Yeah. It's, this is my second marriage. I was married back in 1995 and it lasted a 4.5 years. And, you know, when I think about it, it's kind of like that discussion about sponsorship. I should have said no to that marriage. I was still a child. I was not an adult who was ready to be the kind of husband that someone should be. And it was more of a father-daughter relationship. It wasn't great. And the more she acted like a child, the more I, you know, imposed myself as an adult, and it just disintegrated from there. And so what I learned from that is, first of all, I wasn't ready. And then when I was ready, I was older. I was 40 and had done a little bit of reading and developing and some books. And one of the things I read about was this in a book. The author started the book with the gift of the Magi, that old tale. I don't know if it's like Aesop or whoever, you know, but it's this story where of selflessness, and where the woman had this long, beautiful hair, and he had this little pocket watch, and they didn't have enough money to get each other an anniversary gift, so he sold his watch and bought her this golden hair clip. And when he went to give it to her, she started crying because she took off her thing because she had cut her hair and sold it to buy a chain for his pocket watch. And I'm getting goosebumps as I tell the story. I'm like, that's the kind of husband I want to be. And that's the kind of wife I would like to meet. Now, is this story, it's a little fantasy, but what I'm saying is that, can I be the kind of person who is willing to be giving with, you know, I'll say very little strings attached. Now, I won't say no strings attached, but just for the sake of being giving, you know, and I each morning when I do my meditation, I ask myself, you know, God, can you help me be the kind of husband my wife wants to come home to every day? And I'm not every day the kind of husband she wants to come home to. There are days when it's like, can you go back for a ride and come back, you know? But most of the time, and you know, and she had a son from a previous marriage, and I realized today that they invited me into their lives rather than me pushing myself in, and I'm glad I became the kind of man that was able to help raise him, you know, and be a good husband and be a good father, and so that's kind of my story in that. I mean, there's a lot more than that, but you know. It's the selflessness, really, the giving, the 12th step that has propelled me into becoming married as long as I have to a woman who's as wonderful as I got. Because it's like I look sometimes and like, how does she put up with me? How does she, you know? Even my son says to her some of my goofiness. He's like, how do you put up? And she's like, she says, I've seen some of the others. He's pretty good.
So she's very sweet. Yeah. Thank you for saying that. Cause I think it is that maturity, you know, that you had to grow up.
I did.
Right. You had to.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, prior to meeting her, I was volunteering as a big brother. So that was like, developing my selflessness, that I didn't realize I needed developed, but it really, I did. And it made a big difference in becoming a better husband and father. So
great.
As I you know, I don't know if you've listened to any episodes, but I usually wrap up with a book, you know, some book that enhanced your journey. And you gave me a list of many of them. And the one I would actually like you to talk about, because we kind of have in common, I first heard about, was The Road Less Traveled by M. Scott Peck. Can you talk a little bit about how that has enhanced your recovery?
Absolutely. I still have the book. Mm-hmm. It's all taped up and worn and yellowed and dog-eared. And I don't know how I happened upon that book. It must have been mentioned in some circle or mm-hmm. perhaps in a meeting or somewhere. And I got it, and I, you know, that first line, life is difficult, you know, and just that was honest. Hmm. I thought that is so honest. And when I read it and reread it, how he talks about maturity and love, especially love being a responsibility, being a decision, you know, maturity, it helped me. It helps me remember that it starts with me, and that the reality of life, that it's difficult. You know, these times especially seem especially difficult. Mm-hmm. So I saw M. Scott Peck in Manhattan. He gave a talk, and he's written several other books, A Different Drum and People of the Lie. But what I liked most about him, he said two things that I really liked. He said, you know, they think I'm such this, you know, high, you know, philosopher, or that I'm so great, that I get to have 4 hours in the morning all to myself. Nobody bothers me. Nobody to my wife, my son. So I kind of sit there for 4 hours and I kind of talk to God. Hmm. I thought, wow, 4 hours. Wow. Well, yeah. You know, but they gave him that time. He's, you know, and he said that time with God really helped him. And then he sang the Cat Stevens song. I can't let it in. Wait, I can't hold it in. I got to let it out. I'll send it to you. He sang this song about love and how love is really the answer and love is the way to go. And I think the essence of that book is love.
Hmm. Yeah. Well, thank you. So do you have anything else you'd like to talk about? Anything I left out, or, you know, to use the platform to just get something out there? Any one last message or anything?
Oh, I would want to say, which was I was told over and over, don't drink no matter what. Okay. If your ass falls off or it turns to gold, you know, don't drink. That's what they used to say. And I really truly believe that. Don't drink, you know, pick up the phone, you know, text, whatever you have to do, get to a meeting, get on a Zoom call. Don't drink, you know, not today. And I also want to say that, you know, when it says in our preamble, to achieve sobriety, you know, our primary purpose is to stay sober and help another alcoholic to achieve sobriety. I want to say that, you know, for me today, my definition of sobriety is more emotional sobriety. And I feel like wherever you're at, no matter how much time that you have, that achieving that sobriety, is important, you know, just to remember it's not just for the newcomer. Mm-hmm. That achieving that sobriety on a daily basis could be with somebody with 20, 30, 40 years, because they need to achieve that sobriety too every day.
Yeah. Okay. And do you have any other questions for me? Anything you want to ask me
about? Well, your marriage, you spoke about your marriage. Yep. How old is your son?
He's 24 now.
And how is it? Tell me about parenting a teenager.
Well, one of the things I tried to keep in the forefront when I married my wife, and, you know, she has already a relationship established with this young man. He was, I think, 10 or 11. And again, I'm invited. So to start with, I'm a guest. I'm not quite family yet, even though you know, on paper I am. And I had to realize that while they were being polite and asking for my input into a decision, it really wasn't my decision. It was really my wife. It's really her son. And of course, he has a father also. So things that were developing at that age, you know, there's a lot of considerations, and I was last. So I had to understand that. I think the other piece is that when it comes to teenagers, so I now teach high school. I think there's this illusion that because they look like adults, that we think they're going to behave like adults. And what it is, they could be 16 years old and 6 inches taller than me and bigger than me. And only because I have gray hair does it look like I look older than them. And what happens is, but they still have a 17-year-old mind, and they still make the decisions at best of a 17-year-old. That's usually of an 11-year-old or an 8-year-old. And that's the piece that I think with young adults or children that I've learned is they need much more empathy than we think they need. They need much more support and structure than we think. Because, they'll be fine on their own. Okay, well, yeah, they don't have to need help going to the washroom anymore. They know how to brush their teeth. They know how to make their lunch. But they still need a lot of guidance on foolish decisions that in some cases can cost them quite a bit if they're not careful, you know. I mean, in the high school situation, we have this detention situation. Okay, you do something wrong, you sit in a room for 40 minutes with a teacher and you're not supposed to do homework and all that. But thank God that's all that's happening to you, because if you continue this behavior of I don't have to follow the rules, there's going to be someone who's going to say, no, this rule you have to follow, and now you're in jail. So I try to, because I actually do the detention duty sometimes, and I try to impose that upon them, say, understand that this is not a bad punishment for what you're going through, and if you don't learn something from this, there's worse punishments for worse behavior out there. So I think that's the thing, that they just don't understand the finality of life in a way, that there's decisions and consequences. Because they're used to playing video games. They get one more, look, I get another guy, or I can pay for another thing and go on. And it's like, so all their mistakes get taken care of and corrected in this world of social media or video gaming, that it's like, well, you won't have a consequence or something. And me and you know that, okay, but there will be one day. And if you're not taught how to deal with it, you're going to get yourself in some real trouble, you know? So that's probably the biggest thing I've learned about, young adults and teenagers.
Thank you. And I think just what you said too about they need structure, they need guidance. They may look, it may seem as if, but it feels like now more so than when they were little. It feels like now that they really, I have a 15-year-old, and it's challenging, it's just very challenging. And I realize I really need to be here more so than when he was little.
Yeah. Yeah. They need more limits now, and they don't want them.
No.
Well, thank you again for being a gracious guest, and for really, sharing a lot of your story. And I know a lot of people are going to get help from a lot of things that you're talking about. And, very, very happy for some of the changes you've made and for some of the progress you've made. So thank you.
Thank you, Howard. Thank you for your service. Appreciate it. It's been great. It's been great to be with you.
Thank you. We have come to the end of this episode of the Seasons of Sobriety podcast. I trust that you were able to identify with the personal story of our guest and perhaps apply some of their experience to give you the hope needed to persevere through your own journey. If you'd like to contact the show, please send an email to podcast@seasonsofsobriety.com. The email address can be found in the show notes. This podcast has been completely self-funded. If you believe today's episode has been beneficial, I ask that you either contribute a little extra this week to your home group or another organization close to your heart. Until next time, Remember, if you have trouble practicing the principles of the steps in all your affairs, you may have too many affairs.